Welcome. You are listening to Our Burning Questions, a professional learning podcast where we ask brilliant educators everything you've ever wondered about teaching English language learners. I'm your host, Colette Ferrone-Goodwin, and I'm a resource specialist on the ENL team with the Mid-State Regional Bilingual Education Resource Network at OCM BOCES in Syracuse, New York. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, colleagues, and welcome to another episode of Our Burning Questions. Today's burning questions are, what are the most common myths about second language acquisition? And the second one is, how do we move beyond those myths in current practice? And to address these questions today, we are joined today by Dr. Sonia Sotero. She is an expert with many years in the field of bilingual education and English language learner education. And we are very excited to have her here today. Please join us in welcoming Dr. Sotero. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. This is very exciting. My passion to talk about these issues, and I share the passion with all of you as well. So thank you for having me.
Great. Thank you so much. So for those of our guests who are not familiar with you and your work, could you please just share a little bit about you, your title, your role, your position?
Of course. So right now I am the Department Chair of Leadership, Language, and Curriculum at DePaul University in Chicago. Prior to that, I've been doing that for quite a bit of time. I am also in the Bilingual Bicultural Education program at DePaul. And so I teach courses for the bilingual and ESL endorsement, and also literacy and biliteracy courses. And before that, so I work with teachers and leaders. I prepare teachers and leaders to work with developing bilinguals in the field, as well as others that end up working in places like museums and non-for-profits in relationship to immigrant communities and language learners. Before that, I was a teacher, a bilingual and dual language teacher in Chicago Public Schools. And before that, I was a bilingual and dual language teacher in Tucson, Arizona, where I worked with the Native American tribe, the Yaqui, Yoemi tribe in Tucson. And I did get all my degrees from the University of Arizona. So I'm a transplant to Chicago.
Fantastic. I imagine it's a different, whole different atmosphere.
Yes, right? Yes. I went from very hot to very cold.
Yes, that's true. You went from Arizona where the dry heat to Chicago, the windy city.
Yes. The deep freeze.
Yes.
I also am a product myself of bilingual education in Latin America. And certainly, if we have time, we can talk about the differences in what bilingual education is in outside of the United States and what it is here. So I am a product. So in essence, I have been immersed in bilingual education my entire life.
Yeah. So, and you've been on both sides, right?
Yes.
Yes. So I know you kind of touched upon it during your introduction, but what are your special areas of interest?
So my special areas of interest include biliteracy. I worked under Yetta Goodman many, many years ago. Also Luis Moll and Richard Ruiz at the University of Arizona. So I am a bit of interest in practice, which is biliteracy and bilingualism, and how to teach and how to create programs. I'm also very interested in language policy. I have done research and published on Latino education as well.
Thank you. And so what drew you to working with ELLs? I think you kind of touched on it a little bit, but.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. I ended up falling in love when I was about 21 years old, when I graduated. And my bachelor's degree was in elementary education. Nobody told me, I never thought I was bilingual and biliterate. And probably like 2 or 3 weeks before school started in Tucson, I got hired as a bilingual teacher. And so it wasn't my intent to be a bilingual teacher. And I got hired and I worked with the Native American in the outskirts of the Native American reservation. And I just fell in love from day one with bilingual education, and then decided, oh, I have an elementary bachelor's degree, but I need to learn about second language acquisition, about bilingual education and bilingualism. I didn't know I was bilingual, but I wasn't trained or prepared. So I got my master's degree in bilingual education at the University of Arizona, and then went on to do the doctorate as well. And I just, it was meant to be, but it was a fluke, which is, it's not a good thing, because nobody told me when I was an undergrad that bilingual education would be a good path for me, for somebody who was bilingual and biliterate.
Yeah, and that's interesting that you bring that up, because nowadays we place so much emphasis on bilingualism as being an asset, and we know that needs to be shared early on for all students, even those who aren't considering going into education, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So our first guiding question talks about myths regarding second language acquisition. So, and I'm sure a lot of these, I'm sure you've heard these all before, but you know, the first one, you know, sometimes we hear people say, teachers say, isn't it true that all ELDs need is just good teaching and that bilingual education or ENL classes will just slow them down?
Yes, so this is very, very common. So I always, I'm not the only one, others in the field talk about, you know, practices that are good for English learners are good for everyone versus the other way around. And I'll talk a little bit about this later, but it's very problematic that we implement, we apply, we adopt English-oriented practices for English learners. And by the way, the English learner field, and as other education fields, we love acronyms and we love labels, and all of them are not quite right. And so I kind of stopped, I'm trying to stop saying English learners, even though that's the common recognized nomenclature. But I've started using developing bilinguals. And developing bilinguals rather than emergent bilinguals. I don't quite like emergent bilinguals because it implies that they're stuck at emergent level. So I started using developing bilinguals instead. Now there's a bit of a problem with that terminology, because that also may include in dual language programs that are two-way would include also English learners who are, English speakers who are learning Spanish or Chinese or French as a second language. So developing bilingual, but I think that it emphasizes, rather than emphasizing English, emphasizes the bilingual aspect. So it's critical that we understand sort of these myths in terms of the problem of not understanding second language acquisition that leads to faulty and misguided decision-making about instructional materials, about assessments, about instructional practices, about things like RTIs that are designed for English speakers. They're not designed for English as a second language learner. And so we have lots of issues with that. So it's very critical to understand the differences between a learner, generally a learner, and an English language learner. And so it's very important that we distinguish those two things, and we by distinguishing them, we need to have understanding about what does bilingualism mean and what does second language acquisition mean. So I have a friend who once said, for example, we shouldn't do Spanish literacy a la English, which is what we often do.
Right.
So we shouldn't be, if we understand second language acquisition, then we are not going to be doing implementing assessments that are designed for English speakers for second language learners, which we do a lot of and we shouldn't be doing. And also for assessment purposes, you don't get very accurate data if we're doing that.
Thank you. So this next myth kind of ties in with what you just shared, this idea of a grandfather myth. That, you know, maybe perhaps speakers of other languages or immigrants were they were just fine in the past without bilingual education or English language support. So, you know, why now? What's the purpose? Why?
So the grandfather myth, Stephen Krashen talks about this and has used this as an example. So this is a grandfather myth, thinking that your grandfather, great grandfather at this point, came to the United States and didn't have bilingual education, didn't have ESL, didn't have any specialized instruction or support, is a little bit misguided, because typically the grandfather came when they were maybe young adults. Typically they came when perhaps they were already had some kind of trade. So I sometimes use the example of, you know, if your grandfather came and was a carpenter, for example, already had that knowledge, and so just needed to have additional sort of language, English language terminology. But the fact that the person who came as a young adult already had world knowledge and a trade, for example, is quite different than and coming to the United States as a young child or even as an adolescent and having to contend with academic subjects in a language they do not know. And so what we also know is that in the early 1900s and before bilingual education came into play, there were many, many immigrants who came from poverty who dropped out of school or never went to school. And so it is a bit of a myth that the grandfather argument really doesn't fall flat. Also, if the grandfather came and did well, typically has something to do with having schooling in their native language. So if your grandfather came from Germany and graduated from high school or in German, that's a de facto bilingual education, because you got your education in your native language, in German or French or Polish or whatever language, or Chinese. And so there are a lot of flaws to that argument that we need to sort of scratch the surface to get at. It's really apples and oranges that we're comparing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me think about my own grandparents who came from Italy. My grandmother was illiterate because her mother was sick and she had to stay home and take care of her. So she spoke broken English, you know, her whole life. And so I had to go to learn Italian so that I could talk to her in Italian.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So talking about immigrants, what about the myth? How would you respond to the myth that immigrants refuse to learn English?
So we know that is truly a myth. And I think that often comes from, I know in Chicago, we have various neighborhoods that are very heavily of one language or another. And so particularly Spanish, we have two big neighborhoods, Pilsen and Little Village. And so oftentimes there's a lot of Spanish being spoken in the streets. There's a lot of Spanish signage all over. And the misconception or the mythology is that, look at them, they don't speak Spanish, they don't speak English. Well, number one, we're making assumptions that they don't speak English. The majority are bilingual. They just can speak both in English and Spanish. And so we hear in those kind of neighborhoods a lot of Spanish because it's a Latino community. Also, what we know from research and what we know the phenomenon is that by the third generation, and like you said yourself, by the third generation, the children no longer speak the language of the heritage, but speak the dominant language of society. And that happens here in Latin America and everywhere. And what we've seen in the last maybe 20, 30 years is by the second generation, particularly because of the pull of English is very, very strong. And therefore, even within the generation where we see this phenomenon of the parents don't speak English and the children don't speak the parents' language. And all kinds of very detrimental things happen when that occurs. And so I want to read from my book just a little bit on that, in terms of when teachers, particularly teachers, tell parents to speak English at home when they don't speak English very well, what happens. this is from my book, School-Wide Approaches to Educating English Language Learners. When teachers tell non-English proficient parents to speak English at home, there's a break in the family harmony because the parents are no longer sort of are able to impart the values and impart all the things that come with communication between parent and children. Emotional attachments become at risk. Important values and norms are not transferred from parent to child. The parent's authority is weakened because the children very quickly, very early and very young, discern that, I speak English, my parents don't, I must be smarter than my parents, and therefore it erodes their authority. And then children also develop this self-shame about their origins, about their names, about their parents having accents. And so it's really the one thing that I always, if people, when they hear me, take anything from all of this, is please, please don't tell parents to speak English at home. That's the very worst thing we can do. And oftentimes it's with the most wonderful intentions, but it's really very, very detrimental and has long-term effects.
So I think you kind of addressed, you know, the speaking English at home already. You kind of touched upon that, but can you speak to what, you know, how does that affect the students learning English in school? What does using the home language, what benefits does using the home language at home have on students learning English at school?
So what we know from many decades of research is that developing a sound base of the native language at home, you know, we always talk about the parents are the children's first teachers. It's very critical, not just linguistically and cognitively, but also the social emotional aspect of having that connection with the home language and the home culture. And so we know that the students and the children that have developed a strong language background in their L1 are at an advantage when they come into school because a lot of those things transfer. The premise of bilingual education, we talk about how no one, even the English-speaking students, for the most part, come to school with academic English. So, and therefore, why we're expecting Spanish-speaking students or Chinese-speaking students or Arabic-speaking students coming with Arabic, academic Arabic to school? Where do you develop academic language? In school, over a long period of time. So that's why bilingual education is so critical, additive bilingual education, over a long period of time to develop that academic Arabic, academic Urdu, academic Spanish, and it happens in school. So developing the types of the different registers of language. So I use the example of the word thus in English. And so right now I'm not using the word thus, I could. But when I talk to my neighbor or my family, I don't use the word thus because it's weird. I use the word so. And so where do we learn the word thus? Where do we use the word thus? As adults in the profession, as professionals in school, in academic papers or in academic presentations. Mm-hmm. And you develop that like kind of language in school, unless parents are doing homeschooling, which is a different conversation.
Yes, definitely. Okay, great. Thank you. So how would you respond to someone that said, if only this family had come to New York when the kids were younger, it would have been easier for them to learn English?
So if only they had come earlier?
Mm-hmm. When they were younger.
So you mean that the myth of the younger is better?
Yes.
So this is a big one, a big myth that I think is the most common myth is that, young children learn and just they pick up language. Well, it's not quite that simple. And they may pick up language, but what kind of language are they picking up? They're picking up sort of conversational social language. And the type of language that they're picking it up because they have more time when they're young. And also younger children have more motivation, usually playing is a big one. And so they have more, probably more access to English speakers in the case of language, of developing bilinguals. And we have to think, you know, again, scratch below the surface. Where is the child? Does the child have a lot of siblings? Because that's another phenomenon that we know, is that if you're the older child, you will know the language of your parents much more than the younger children. And why that phenomenon happens? Because the more children that are in the household, the older children that have gone to school and have acquired English will communicate with the younger siblings in English, in the language of the dominant society. And this happens in Latin America and in all other countries, that the children quickly learn, this is the language of television, this is the language of play, this is the language of internet now. And so the communication happens more interactively with the siblings than with the parents. If you have a single, an only child, then there is more of that native language development and maintenance. It's a little bit easier, not entirely easy.
Thank you. So,
One more thing, sorry. Okay. One more thing about this myth about younger is better. Think about that. Younger children have to learn both content and language, whereas adolescents or adults, they already come with more background knowledge, more word knowledge. And particularly for adults or adolescents, they also have more cognitive understanding of developing learning how we learn and what do I need to do as an adult to have those skills, right? That, oh, if I write it down, then I will remember, or if I do some kind of mnemonic device, I will learn something. And young children don't have that cognitive awareness of the learning processes.
Thank you. So when talking about the myth that more English is better, how would you respond to someone who says, I tell my students in my class, no Spanish, only English, because how else are they going to learn to be successful in school unless they're using English all the time?
Yeah, so this myth is the time on task myth that Jim Cummings talks about. And it comes from this notion of immersion, and that immersion is good. And the notion of immersion, yeah, it's wonderful for world language development, right? And that type of immersion. Oh, I'm in a French immersion program, but the society is all in English. So my English is not at risk of me forgetting it, or me, you know, just going strict to French. And also, you know, the notion of study abroad. I'm going to go to Canada, Quebec, or I'm going to go to France to be immersed in French. It's this, again, apples and oranges comparison. So that the time on task and more immersion idea is good for when the society does not have that language. In the case of English learners, the entire society is in English. And therefore, the risk of losing the native language and shifting to the English language is very high. Also, the notion of just throw more English at the students without specialized instruction is very problematic, because that is not necessarily immersion, that is submersion, when we talk about sink or swim. So we just throw the kids into a general education program, especially in elementary, is very problematic. Thinking about students who are developing bilinguals, don't know a lot of English, are in the mainstream or gen ed classroom, and they get 45 minutes a day, if that, of ESL pullout. So the rest of the time, be it 6 hours or however many hours it is, they're in a sink or swim situation, because typically the teachers don't have background and training and preparation. And if they do, and I was a teacher, and I'm for a couple of years, I had 32 kids in my class. And so how do I, if I'm a gen ed teacher and I have several English learners in my classroom of different proficiency levels, how realistic is it that I'm going to make modifications and have the preparation and background to be able to use ESL strategies for the students, to incorporate ESL instructional materials for those students? The reality is that's really tough to do as a gen ed in elementary classroom. And so it's very problematic that we have that situation with a sink or swim immersion, submersion. And we know what happens to most of those students, they don't do well. So the idea of just throw more English is not something that is supported by what we see in terms of students' academic achievement and the research, what the research tells us.
And I think to that point, you know, it kind of emphasizes the importance of having an ENL teacher, ESL teacher in the classroom to provide that support, because they have that specialized expertise. And I'm not sure about, you know, the regulations in Illinois or in Arizona, but in New York State, it's like integrated instruction is required. It's part of their units of study. So, it's required that the right. ENL teacher work with the content area teacher to make sure that those supports are done and that, they're taught explicitly.
In a perfect world, every single teacher in the United States would have an ESL endorsement. Yes. I know you don't call it endorsement in New York, right?
We call it certification right. Or an extension.
An extension, yes. Mm-hmm. So, I think about it, you don't have to have another language to have an ESL extension.
Right.
We can all have an ESL extension or yes. endorsement. And so, for example, in my university and some other universities in Illinois and other states, they incorporate one or two courses of ESL or bilingual education in all teacher preparation programs. Mm-hmm. But there's a big disconnect with the teacher preparation and leadership preparation. So there is no course designated in leadership preparation for English learners. And we have now, 11% in the United States, close to what a special education students. I think it's 12% or something like that in the US.
That's amazing. And astonishing, right?
Yes.
At the same time.
Yes.
And that's another myth too that you touched upon, was that, okay, well, how can I teach English language learners if I don't know their language? So that's another myth that we encounter a lot too.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. So moving on to kind of talking about the difference between, social language versus academic language. You've talked about that. A teacher might say, oh, I hear my students speak English all the time with their friends in the cafeteria, in the hallways. But then when I ask a question in class, they never respond and their work isn't done well. So it must be a behavior issue. How would you respond to that?
Behavior issue or motivational issue? Why are they quiet? Why aren't they talking? Mm. And so we have, again, a cultural mismatch in that we expect the students to speak up, look at me in the eyes and all those kind of things. And one might be cultural, that you don't speak back to the teacher. And certainly for English learners and developing bilinguals, is that we know all of us have more receptive knowledge of a language than expressive. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of the silent period, and that students are developing the language, but there is a silent period. There is, not for all the students, but for most, where we're taking it in. We're learning by observing. So, pressuring students to speak before they're ready is problematic. I want to read from my book, chapter one, the case of Adesh that I talk about in the book. And it correlates with the notion of speaking. Oh, so the student is already proficient because I heard the student speaking in the hallway or in the playground, but also expectations that we have of certain groups of students. So Adesh spent his early childhood on the north side of Chicago in a culturally and linguistically rich and lively community made up of mostly Indian, Pakistani, and Bangladeshi descent population, where he felt at home surrounded by familiar sounds, smells, and sights. Now a young adult, he remembers being happy and thriving during those years. When he turned 6, however, the family moved to a mostly white suburb because of his father's new job. It was not long before Adesh began to be teased by his new suburban classmates for the way he looked, the lunch food he brought to school, his name, his heavy accent and broken English, and many other things that made him feel rejected by his new school and ashamed of his background. Beyond having to put up with his peers' teasing, he had to deal with teachers who, although well-meaning, were full of stereotypes and unrealistic expectations. He remembers teachers commenting on how all Indians speak English and how Indian kids are very smart, so he does not need ESL. He also painfully remembers that he never had much to share in class because his experiences and stories were so different from those of the other students. To cope, he ended up inventing stories about his summer vacations and what gifts he got for Christmas, which his family did not celebrate. Adesh quickly adopted the American English way of speaking from his peers in an effort to fit in and be accepted by his classmates. Unfortunately, his quick acquisition of conversational skills led teachers to believe that he was fully proficient in English and capable of tackling academic subjects at the same level as his English-speaking peers. Adesh remembers struggling with academic subjects, especially in literacy and social studies, not having sufficient background with academic English or American history and culture. Adesh's experiences illustrate how several factors interact to influence this. And so understanding that just speaking the language is not, like, remember the word thus? So I can speak English, but if I don't know the word thus, because I don't have that academic English, it's not the same. For Adesh, what once was a very healthy self-esteem quickly turned into insecurity and a negative self-image when his family enrolled him in a school that had little understanding of his background and also little understanding of second language acquisition. And so expectations are also something that is very critical, that we have certain expectations, bad or good, for certain groups. And I remember when I was a teacher, I had a colleague who said, said to me, well, these students are not going to amount to anything anyway. So those kind of comments are really the expectations that we bring into the classroom that we have to check at the door. Everybody's entitled to their opinion, but as teachers, we're really responsible for having high expectations, but expectations that are within the reach, no? So no proximal development. So if they, you know, the notion of having these children lift themselves by their bootstraps, they need to have bootstraps first to be able to do that. And so English is that bootstrap, but it's something that is acquired over a long period of time.
Absolutely, thank you. And thank you for reading that quote from your book. I think that it's, you know, it's very helpful to have those kinds of scenarios shared. Would you mind sharing the title of your book? And we can certainly share that with our listeners.
Yes, of course. So I have 3 books. This one is from School-Wide Approaches to Educating ELLs, Creating Linguistically and Culturally Responsive K-12 Schools. And I wrote this book because I'm a dual language proponent. I have another book on dual language education, but not everybody can do dual language. If you have multiple languages, if you don't have the number of bilingual teachers and all those things. And so, and I also wrote this book because this is a school-wide approach and a district-wide approach. We know, those of us who are in the field of bilingual education and ESL, that it has been, historically, those teachers will take care of those kids. So the ESL and bilingual teachers over there will take care of those kids. No, it has to be school-wide approach. We all take care of those kids. And so we have to have accountability, but it also has to have a school-wide approach. That we're all in this together in addressing the needs of all the students and not just leave it to the bilingual and ESL teachers.
Yeah, it makes me think about the principles, the 8 principles of the Blueprint for L Success that we have in New York State. And the very first one says, all teachers are teachers of Ls.
Yeah. And we should revise that to say, and all school leaders and district leaders are school leaders and district leaders of ELLs.
Yes.
Because again, is something that I know you were going to talk about it before. I'm jumping around a little bit.
That's okay.
What do we do moving forward? And to me, moving forward is, you know, grassroots is great. And I was a teacher for 14 years. But unfortunately, education is a hierarchy. And so if you don't have the very highest decision makers understand and committed, the best teachers on the grounds are gonna have their hands tied, because decision makers are making the wrong decisions. So I, for example, this book I wrote for board of education members of mine, superintendents of mine, assistant superintendents of mine, district level school leaders who don't have, most of them don't have the preparation and understanding. And so for them to embrace, not only embrace the responsibility of educating these students and embrace the responsibility that we have to their families, but also embrace the potential of these students and their families, the cultural and the linguistic capital that they bring, their richness, all of those things should be just celebrated and incorporated into the curriculum. I know it's easier said than done, but if there's a will, there's a way, and there's a will that is well informed, there's really a way. So,
absolutely. Thank you. That sounds like a fascinating resource, and I think I might have to get that book.
I show it.
Oh, sure.
The book.
Thanks. Okay.
People won't be able to see it.
Right, but we will. We'll make sure that we, you know, put a cover, you know, picture of the cover on our website, and share a link to the publisher so that they can purchase if they like. Awesome. Thank you.
And if administrators, and a lot of them are interested in doing additive bilingual education when you have all the ingredients in place. Mm-hmm. The other book I was dual language education. Mm-hmm. Program design and implementation that also requires the will, because dual language education and dual language programs are challenging to implement, to plan, and require a long-term commitment. And so if we're going to do bilingual education, why not do additive bilingual education like they do in other parts of the world, like in Europe and Canada, and in, like the school that I went to in Latin America, that was pre-K through 12th grade.
Wow, that's amazing. Wonderful. All right, thank you. So I have one final myth, and that one is around the fact that learning two languages causes confusion. You know, there's this idea that, you know, that maybe, you know, grandparents should only be speaking English to their grandson because they don't want to confuse them. How would you respond to that?
So this myth has been around a long, long time, and all of us in bilingual education and language education, we know this is not the case. For time immemorial, we've had bilingualism, multilingualism across history, across the world. It does not lead to confusion. This came from, but in the United States, it came from the early 1950s or so, where English learners, particularly Mexican English learners in the southern part of the United States, were placed in special education programs because they didn't speak English. And so they confounded the not knowing English, or not having English yet, with having cognitive disabilities of some kind. And so this has been something that has prevailed over time. And also because the phenomenon as a developing by a young child, yes, young children do mix the two languages, but eventually those two languages become separated, not entirely separated, because we're not, you know, we have the whole, the translanguaging and the sort of, we are one, it's, we're not two monolinguals in one body, where we are a bilingual in one body. So those two or three languages that we have interact with each other. But most bilinguals can separate. When I'm speaking to a monolingual Spanish speaker, I will not be mixing English because I know that person's not going to understand me. And the same with a monolingual English speaker. And so the notion that children will get confused is completely it's not validated by any research at all. And so it doesn't confuse students. Now, if students develop bilingualism where they're mixing the two languages and code mixing and translanguaging all the time, then other things might be at play, but not confusion. So I don't know, I'm confused, but not because I'm bilingual. So, you know, correlating those things is not, why am I confused? Because I don't have enough sleep or other reasons, but not because I'm bilingual. So, yeah. Okay.
Awesome, thank you. I was also gonna say that, you know, there's also studies out there that, you know, being bilingual is actually a higher cognitive function, right? So, you know, it's a process because they take it in one language, they have to translate it to their home language and then translate it back and formulate an answer. And so it's this very elevated cognitive process.
Yes, we have lots of proof that bilingualism has many, many cognitive advantages. Why? Because we have two languages and that we're always having to, we're more nimble because we always, I have to suppress my Spanish right now. I don't do it consciously, right? Yeah. But when I'm with a bilingual, I don't have to suppress either one.
Right.
But I have to be with a bilingual Spanish-English speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm with a Spanish monolingual, I'm just suppressing my English. And so therefore, my brain, bilingual brains are more flexible in that way.
Mm-hmm.
We can think outside the box. But also bilingualism and biliteracy, not just bilingualism, has economic advantages, has sociocultural advantages, and so beyond sort of the cognitive, has academic advantages. So there's so many advantages to developing bilingualism, but also biliteracy, because biliteracy is sort of like, in some sense, a higher level of bilingualism, to include that those skills of reading, writing, listening, and speaking.
We actually, in New York State, we actually have a credential that seniors are able to add to their diploma, the Seal of Biliteracy. So
the Seal of Biliteracy is fabulous. So I don't know if it started with California in 2011. And then now, 9 years later, we have 30, I think the last I counted was 34 states have passed the Seal of Biliteracy and its legislation. And so I always wonder how that happens so quickly, because legislation is very slow.
Yeah.
And I know why, because, you know, many legislators are white, middle class, and they want their own children to have that seal, to have that benefit of being biliterate. And so, I mean, that spread like wildfire. So, and I think now we only have one state that is not thinking about it, but peer pressure.
Yeah, right.
I think it's North Dakota, I don't know. But everybody else is either thinking about it, the ones beyond the 34 that have passed legislation, or in the process of getting a seal of biliteracy in their state.
Awesome, thank you. Yeah, and I think, you know, in terms of that seal of biliteracy, you know, you made a good point about, you know, about the white, you know, representatives that want their children to be bilingual. We also need to emphasize those English language learners and what a benefit it is for them to have it as well.
Right.
So, thinking about all of these myths that we've just addressed, which ones do you think are the most prevalent in the districts that you support?
The most prevalent are English. More English is better. Mm-hmm. So the time on task, immersion in English, and they will just pick it up. I think that's one of the most prevalent, that just doesn't go away. And also that young children pick up English quickly and easily. And so those two are very insidious in some way, because they just will not go away. And in the last 10 years or so, I've seen, and others have seen, this phenomenon of the notion of applying the special education approach to mainstreaming and inclusion, and doing inclusion for English learners, which is problematic. So it's sort of like connected to this more English is better and children pick up language. And the inclusion approach for English learners is really misguided, because, again, apples and oranges, special education students are part of that inclusion and mainstreaming, but they have an IEP. And so they're protected by that IEP. Whereas English learners or developing bilinguals, when they are in that inclusion setting, that, which I call sink or swim, they're not protected by an IEP. So that's very problematic in terms of thinking of more English is better, and it's easy for them to pick up English because they're young. So those are the two, I think, prevalent myths. And also, I think the myth that, it's not quite a myth, it's just a misguided interpretation of good instruction, that good instruction, like we started the discussion, good instruction is good instruction for all. Mm-hmm. And that's not quite, yes, many of the approaches are very good for language learners, but we have to have specially designed second language instructional approaches and strategies. And where do you learn those? You learn those by understanding second language acquisition and how to address the needs of the students and what are the best practices. And where does that happen? Usually at the university, because professional development is great and we need professional development, but there's not enough to do that, to have the, just the professional development.
And so I think I have a feeling that the next question that I want to ask is that how have you seen districts work to debunk some of these myths? And I have a feeling that some of that information is in the book that you read from.
Yes. So of course, book clubs and reading books and getting an, I mean, of course, it's difficult to do that because people are very busy. Right. But I've worked with districts where I love working with these type of districts that really have a love, the leadership has a love of reading, of professional reading, and they're always buying books and professional books for their for the other leaders, for the teachers, for the school principals, everybody's reading. I think those are the best districts that, that have that love of reading themselves. To me, it's really looking at the leadership and having leadership in people in leadership positions that are, have expertise and knowledge and experience. So bilingual and ESL, former teachers, bilingual and ESL, endorsed people at the district level is critical. And not just in the multilingual department, but also in other departments, because this is one of the flaws with many, the way that the districts are configured is silos. There is the instruction and curriculum silo over here, then there is the assessment silo over there, you know, early childhood is over there. So we have these departments that are siloed and often don't speak to each other. And so in a perfect world, you would have a bilingual ESL person in one of in each one of those departments, as you would have for special education as well. So when people are making decisions in those departments about assessment, you have somebody at the table say, wait, those assessments are not quite appropriate. You're not gonna get the data that you're looking for. But if nobody from that background, bilingual ESL background, is sitting at the table, then decisions are made and it's too late. So that's one way to do that. Of course, that's easier said than done because that takes money and recruiting bilingual and ESL expertise. Of course, PDs, professional development, not just for teachers. You have to have professional development for the leaders, school district and district and district leaders. Very critical to have designated bilingual, multilingual department that is well staffed, that has the sufficient number of people that to provide the supports to the schools and the teachers. A district bilingual EL multilingual director that is working with all these entities and also working with principals, including bilingual, developing bilinguals in all district decisions. And that often is sort of, oftentimes the English learners, the developing bilinguals are sort of like an afterthought. And I've seen this working with several districts in terms of developing frameworks, especially around literacy, and then there's an addendum. we shouldn't be the addendum. We should be integrated and incorporated. It shouldn't be. And then an addendum to me is always like, oh, it's an afterthought. And here for English learners, here's the addendum. That kind of sends a message, right? Especially with districts that have significant numbers of English learners. And also the mission and the vision of a district. Does it incorporate the celebration, the valuing, the use of the all students' languages and cultures? And thinking about the majority of the United States, we come from somewhere else except for Native Americans. And so we have students who are never English learners, but they come from families where a language other than English is spoken. And it's not just about that those students that are now designated as English learners, but former English learners and those who were never English learners, but come from families that are linguistically diverse. So those are just some ways. I know all of this is much easier said than done. And at the higher level than district would be policies. What are the state policies? Is the state, what is the expression, putting their money where their
mouth is? Where their mouth is.
What is the state level policy and the Department of Multilingual Learners looks like? And are their hands tied? And so policy and advocacy with policymakers. And I'm not sure in New York, I would assume yes, but in Illinois, we have several entities. And I'm the co-chair and co-founder of one, ELACHE, where we mobilize. We are talking to legislators. We identify the legislators that might be friendly to bilingual education. And we tap into them to put forth legislation that is supportive of bilingual education and English learners and their families. And so we have to think outside the box of the classroom. We have to think school-wide, district-wide, statewide, and advocating and mobilizing to protect the students and their families' rights that often literally do not have a voice because they don't speak English.
Okay, thank you. Those are all very important considerations, I think. And I think you kind of touched on this already. We've kind of moved into the second burning question, which was, how do we move beyond those myths in current practice? So in other words, you know, once we understand that these are indeed myths, where do we go from there? And how can unveiling the myths around second language acquisition help administrators and building leaders in making decisions about the bilingual programs they have or want to start?
So I think, to me, it has always been, of course, certainly teachers are the most important. But if the leader doesn't buy in or is not knowledgeable, all their efforts are kind of stunted. They can do the best they can in their classrooms, but beyond that, it's very difficult. So it is a challenge to get school leaders to buy in, to become more knowledgeable, to see the beauty of the children, of the English learners and developing bilinguals, and to have the district also. So whenever I can, I try to speak to board members. And so I worked with a group in one district where we had a planning committee, and they invited two board members. And one of the board members was, he was a business owner, Chinese descent, and he was very adamant against bilingual education. And he, you know, this is America, and you know, I want my children to be immersed in English, and I can teach them, you know, Chinese at home, and all those kind of things that we know. And by the end of 6 months of meeting, of becoming educated, of talking, we didn't move him entirely, but he started to see the benefits. He started to see the benefits for his own children who had already shifted to only English. His children didn't speak Chinese. And so he started to see that, oh, maybe some of his positions were a little bit misguided. And we understood where his position came from. His position came from, I don't want my children to suffer the discriminations that I have. because I have an accent, because I speak a different language, because I look different. And so that desire to assimilate as quickly as possible is completely understandable. But the United States is made up of mostly people from somewhere else. And there's richness in that, and we have to embrace that. So thinking about district-wide, school-wide, and state-wide, and how we can't do it all, but we have various people can do different things at different levels.
I think that's a great message to end with. I think that you've given a lot of great insight. And if our listeners would like more information on any of the work that you do, where could they go to find that?
Oh, thank you. So one more thing before I...
Sure.
Sorry, I have so much to say.
That's okay.
I didn't let you talk at all.
Okay.
I talked a lot about leadership. Mm-hmm. I want to also talk about teachers. Mm-hmm. I was a teacher and I advocated. And the way that I advocated is I always went to the principal's office with a group of other teachers. I never went by myself. And that's because there's power and strength in numbers. And I always went to the principal's office with solutions. I never went to the principal's office complaining about this, that, or the other thing, but say, this is how it may be. Here's option A, option B, option C of what we could do. So are there any of these doable? Can we talk about these at the staff meeting? So the teachers are not entirely on their own. They can themselves be agents of their own changes. Mm-hmm. I also had a very good relationship with the parents, and I had identified 2-3 parents who were very vocal, were very smart, and they went to the principal's office and sometimes to the district office, sort of, putting forward solutions to things that were going on that were not quite right. And so that we're not, as teachers, yeah, we close our door and we're in our classroom, but we're not alone. We have to tap into each other.
Yes.
So where to get information about me? I do not have a website or anything like that. Okay. I am at DePaul University. So if you want to reach me, ssoltero@depaul.edu. I've worked with several districts in the state of New York. I've done quite a bit of work with Auburn's and also with New York City and others. So I love New York. If I could live in New York, I would. But here I am in Chicago, and I love Chicago too. But New York is kind of my second home. So I have my website is my university. I don't have a website.
Okay. Well, we can definitely share the titles of your books as references along with the recording, so that our listeners are able to access those and purchase them if they so choose, or maybe share them with their districts even.
Of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am also have just been elected to be on the NABE, National Association for Bilingual Education, executive board. And so hopefully we are going to be engaging in professional development. And we have been engaging in professional development recently, just yesterday or the day before. NABE is offering badges on when you complete a certain number of professional development sessions. And they're offering some of these sessions for free and some others for like a small fee. So that's another way to become involved in NYSAVE, become involved in various groups. That's how you find some therapy and bonding with others. We're on the effort and the struggle together. You're not alone.
Right. Yes. Well, congratulations on your election and to the office. Dr. Soltero, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your expertise and all of your knowledge. And it's just been wonderful having this conversation with you. And maybe we can chat again sometime.
Thank you very much. What a wonderful opportunity. And it was a pleasure to speak. And I spoke too much, but we should have had more of a conversation.
That's okay. This is, you know, this is all about you. So, you're sharing, you know, your knowledge with, you know, with the, you know, with the, you know, with our listeners. So
thank you for the opportunity. I love speaking about my passion, which is pilot education.
Awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you soon.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening today. If you would like to learn more about the brilliant guest we had on today's episode or any of the resources we discussed, please visit the Mid-State Auburn webpage. This podcast is produced by Mid-State Auburn at OCM BOCES, and our theme music is Catalyst from Purple Planet Music. We hope that you'll tune in next time for more of Our Burning Questions.